Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 283. I'm Steve Raker, coming at you from the comic book bunker, along with Andrew the LA Rabbit, Kevin Whirlwind X from Points North in Canada, and returning to the show after too long of an absence, but we had to drag him back because the material is just too close to his wheelhouse, is Diabolical Dave K.
Hey, everybody. What's up? It's been 5 years.
Wow. No way.
Yeah, no, it has, because I checked the date on there.
And let us know what your video podcasts, web stuff is these days.
Well, basically, I'm kind of just turning off everything. I've been just guest hosting on stuff. Like, this is, you know, a good example. So I really don't have anything to promote or anything.
All right.
Put it that way.
So be it. Yeah. You can find Marvel Noise on Twitter at Marvel Noise, and I'm at Steve Raker. Andrew's at LA_Rabbit1. Kevin is WWX Kev, and Dave is a fiend on film. A fiend on film.
Yes.
All one word, right?
Yep.
Excellent. All right. So, what brought Dave K back, do you ask? Well, it's more Marvel Bronze Age magic. It's more Luke Cage. It's another installment of our Power Man retrospective as we've been going through chunks of his issues, kind of chunking things by writer, which has been convenient to do based on the short stays of most of the writers. But they give you, you know, 8 to 12 issues or so, and then they're gone before the next changeover. And it's given us kind of another voice and another look at the Marvel's attempts to find how they want to portray Power. I mean, they got a great selling book here. They got a great character. They just can't really figure out how to please as much of the bottom line as they want to please. And the letters pages in these issues and the past ones kind of portray that back and forth that's been going on with the fans. Some of them love it. Some of them hate it. Some of them like the ghetto talk. Some of them don't want the ghetto talk. Some of them want him fighting Doc Ock. Some of them want him fighting, you know, just street-level characters. So it's been, I think, a real challenge for Marvel to find how they want to have this character manifest on the scene. And this is a time where they got to wait for letters and sales to come in to determine if any of their moves are in the right direction. So these changeovers that are happening every 6 to 8 issues keep suggesting that they're kind of searching for the right mix, don't you think?
And are they still at the bi-monthly mark yet, or are they...
They just went monthly. In the last installment, we just got things over as a monthly book. And here we're having editor Marv Wolfman take over the writing chores as well. So I think he's like, here's what I want. I'm going to do it myself. The issues we've got here tonight are issues 36 through 46 that came to us from the fall of 1976 to the summer of 1977. And like I said, Wolfman's writing. And I think the most obvious difference to me with Wolfman's approach to the book and with scripting are, I mean, the embellishments of the ghetto, of all of the street characters. Things we were talking about last time, that they kept going into some of the backstory and side stories of some of these sort of street creatures and the street folk. That's kind of all gone. Although while Mantlo scripts a couple of the first issues, because Wolfman's got to get his schedules right so he can give the book as much attention as it deserves. And we do get a few sweet Christmases in there when Mantlo's scripting. So that's a nice harken back to, you know, what's gone on in the past. But otherwise, it's a new way of telling the Cage stories.
Well, I also think that having the move, it had to be a good sign, and more stability, the move to longer story arcs. You know, we're getting away from, if you remember, we had all those kind of fill in and short, or they just wrap it up very quickly, it felt like.
Absolutely. Here we get 37 through 40 gives us a 4-issue arc. And then 41 to 43 gives us a 3-issue arc. And then actually still continuing from 43 to 46, it's kind of another 4 issues there. Issue 36, if you recall the last time, they told us that Chemistro would be back in issue number 36. And he was, but it was a reprint of Heroes for Hire number 12, the other appearance of Chemistro.
And I didn't even realize that when you told me, because I'm looking at, I'm sure Kevin has his out. I have my Essential here, and it has the cover, but it doesn't have the book. And I was like, well, what's going on here? And it got me all confused.
They gave it a nice Ron Wilson, Klaus Janson cover, which is nice and shiny. But you know what? It ends up being okay, because a new Chemistro would return in the next issue, even though it was the issue following. And this is the four-part story by now the new writer of the book, for this chunk at least, Marvelous Marv Wolfman.
Isn't that kind of weird? They did a reprint of Chemistro, and then the next issue they use the same title again. Chemistro is back!
At least it's not
I guess we didn't miss out on him.
It's not. At least it's not a rear shot of Chemistro's back. Issue 37 has a really kinetic Rich Buckler, Klaus Janson cover with Luke doing a flip leap kind of and crashing down onto a vehicle. That's real, I think, sweet looking. And I love when Marvel does the, you know, showing the steps of the movement through a different figure that's not all the way heavily inked.
Me as well. As you know, we were just talking about in the Thunderbolt segment from a previous episode, how much I like when they sort of change, play with time within a panel or within an image. Like, that's something comics can do. That's really interesting, I think.
For issue 37, the art team is Ron Wilson with Aubrey Bradford. Luke is heading out to his office, as he is wont to do, and the floor, and in fact, the whole office has been turned to glass. Sweet Christmas. It turns out it's a warning from a big brother. Stay clear. And Cage is like, big who? But the, you know, the fact that the composition of his office has been turned to glass, that sounds like Chemistro stuff. So Luke, he decides he's going to go after Big Brother's operations to figure out, find Chemistro and figure out what's what and to get him off his tail.
This issue here is one of the ones I remember the most from when I was a kid, because, you know, I was telling you before that one of the reasons I want to come back on here to talk about these is I must have read this particular issue to like a million times. So it's like, I know it by heart. And Chemistro is like one of my favorite Marvel villains of all time. Just the idea of him. It's always been pretty cool.
I like how he comes back years later and is sort of an ally, you know, on the run up to issue 100 and stuff. Chemistro sticks around.
I kind of don't remember that much about that part, because I don't think I read any of those issues really too much, so I have to take your word for it.
And I just love the art here, too. I mean, Bradford's inks over Ron Wilson. It's, I mean, it really shows Agent's musculature and a lot of noodling on his face and muscles and stuff. Really, I like that sketchy, it's almost a kind of an immediate dirty look to some of the art.
It's very illustrative, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the early 80s boom of indie books that I love so much.
Sure.
The faces and sort of the, he's very muscular, but it's also got that kind of elongation that used to be, you know, kind of long faces and long bodies, but lots of muscles on it. So for me, it's right in line with remembering those early 80s.
So Luke, he's going to go visit Noah in the hospital. And while he's there, gets attacked by Chemistro. Slips on the glass and all that. Chemistro escapes. Makes the floor extra slick. That sort of business.
What you're forgetting, the most crucial plot point, is big change of Chemistro. He's using his hands.
Yeah.
Some of these things don't work out so well. Like, if a guy has a gadget, sometimes it's not as cool when they just say he has powers.
Yeah, well, so they do kind of explain that in the issue, how this happened in one page.
Well, Chemistro's deal was he was Curtis Carr. He was a a technician, an R&D type who developed the gun that did the chemical changes and stuff. Cage pointed the gun at his own foot when he in a tussle, and he kind of blew his own foot off at the end because everything Chemistro changed was unstable. So with Cage in the hospital and there's all this chemistry business going on, he's not going to go up because Curtis is still in the hospital and he's going to shake him up, or shake him down, I should say, a little, and figure out what's what. And it's not Curtis. Curtis, you know, he's gone straight. He swears. He's still recovering from his injuries. But while in prison, Curtis was forced by a fella named Archibald Morton to give up his secrets. And this new guy made an experimental gun that quite literally blew up in his hand. And he's the new chemistro with no gun. The power had been transferred to the hand. The gun blew up it.
Did it have to do with cobalt and radiation?
There's a lot of cobalt in this run.
I was just like, what? I don't know. You get superpowers or you're going to be dead or something's going to happen.
The best part about reading these back to back to back is they have to mention the original Chemistro shoots his foot like in every issue. So don't worry if you missed it the first time, kids. That's a plot point they're not going to let go.
Well, it's important because he wants to keep coming back to, you know, you're not, you know, this new Chemistro isn't, or Chemistro, as you said, isn't unmasked for a while. So you're kind of not sure. Is it still the original guy or is this a new guy altogether? Marvel Universe is only 10 years, you know, 15 years old here. So they don't have the idea of legacy villains down. You know, it's not that's not a cliche yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cage tracks down Chemistro and they tangle in the street. He's got a couple of good moves here. He turns Cage's shirt into lead and makes him all heavier than he already is in his steel skin, and then turns the ground underneath him into quicksand and lets Cage sink.
Maple syrup.
Yeah, you would think that up in maple syrup capital of the world.
Although I gotta say, also, if you don't know how much Luke Cage weighs, hang on, they're gonna. Oh, that's another quote they give every other issue.
He's always busting out too.
This is true. Issue 38 has a Ron Wilson, Klaus Janson cover, and is drawn by a fill-in team here of Bob Brown, with inks by Jim Mooney. So it's a very much a cleaner, sharper look.
That's one thing, and as we'll see in these issues, is how the art teams change so much. Like this, it's like sometimes it's very jarring because, as we've seen in the first issue, it's just a beautiful looking book, and then the first page of this one, Camacho's head is like so small, and like it's just proportionally everything. You know, there's some really bad panels here.
Yeah, and the way Chemistro's got the lines around his face, like when you mess up the proportions, it looks like a badly drawn Spider-Man head, like when the webs are off, and it's like, oh, whoops.
It did totally give me the feeling of a crazy Spider-Man head, which actually that was kind of fun. I'm like, wow, it's like homage to that first team-up. But there are a few production gimmicks, because there's the one scene where he... in the last issue where he mentions, I've altered the properties of my special skin-colored gloves, but they're yellow. Like, clearly the I don't know what, I guess the colors must have been applied after, but you just feel like somebody let the team down with that one, unless he's got yellow hands.
As issue 38 begins, Luke has sunk through the street into the subway tunnels below New York. And he escapes, you know, he takes a subway train and trips all over a poor woman's chinchilla.
Did you like his Kirby pose, though, when he kind of is doing like a leapfrog action?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. The whole time, though, he's being watched by some cat named the Cheshire Cat.
Yeah, it looks like he breaks out his iPhone there or something.
Designed by Ed Hannigan, of all creators, early in Hannigan's career.
Well, he's also being followed by another guy who's following the Cheshire Cat and Luke Cage. So,
well, Luke goes back to, you know, the movie theater, and they're showing Shane again. I think that must be their go-to flick, good old Alan Ladd.
Well, movie theaters back then, they would show, they would have movies like that, they would show like 2-3 weeks in a row.
Yeah, I think it might have been just like in the last issues that it was showing, you're right. But I know Shane is one of those ones that they keep coming back to on the marquee, and have even used aspects of it, like in the storytelling of the book, like lines of dialogue from the movie and stuff. But, so Cage gets a shower and gets cleaned up and stuff, because he's been down in the sewers, but, oh man, he's got a tough road to hoe here. It's like, his office is still glass, his girl is hassling him, and the IRS is still breathing down his neck. Remember we were talking about that? They were threatening to, like, you know, he's worried that his past is going to be exposed.
Well, they can't find a record of him, that's why.
And he's not paying income tax on all the great business he's doing here as the hero for hire. He's just rolling in it.
Although I got to say, Mantlo might be leaning on the sweet Christmas. I liked it in the old days when he would have Christmas in July or just plain Christmas.
After a visit to Curtis Carr, Luke is again attacked by Chemistro. And he gets like laundry thrown at him and stuff. And tar. This time, though, he's able to take Chemistro down.
But I do like, you could kind of read it like he does rubber and glue. And I was just thinking of that old kid's thing. I'm rubber, you're glue. Because he changes it into rubber and then bounces him and then sticks him with maple syrup.
Well, Cage has had it with this, you know, Chemistro being sent after him, the warning from Big Brother. He goes right after Big Brother, invades his hideout, and Big Brother is a really badly designed cyborg. Badly designed, badly colored.
But he has a big eye on his chest.
Yeah, and he's got the Cheshire Cat there with him.
You know what the other good thing about this issue was? There's a vending machine gag where he gets chicken soup instead of refreshing beverage.
Yeah.
Yes. I was just going to mention that, but Kevin stole my thunder, so...
Yeah, and we had that as a recurring gag in the previous writer's book, so that's kind of a last nod to that. We don't see that again during Wolfman's run, and the book is going to change dramatically in our next installment, so we'll see. That could be
it's
the last.
It's a classic, though.
Yeah, it is. Chicken soup, who would have thought? It's the one combination we didn't see. We saw ice, and then cup, and then drink. We saw everything but. Issue 39 has a Ron Wilson, Jim Mooney cover and has Bob Brown art again, this time with Klaus Janson inks. And we've got Luke Cage and Big Brother hustling in Big Brother's headquarters. And Big Brother, he's tough. He's got the Kirby crackle.
Oh, come on, Steve. You saw a guy in an armored suit. You know you wanted Cage to punch him in the chest like you did with Dr. Doom and Iron Man and everybody else. That's his go-to move.
Big Brother just convinces Cage to stop fighting, even though he's the guy who threw the first punch, and convinces him that Chemistro never was working for him. He really is working for Big Brother's rival, the Baron, this medieval-themed crime lord dude.
Oh, not that Baron.
No, this Baron. The Baron who, you know, the one who's in that castle on top of that giant escarpment there right in New York.
So how much is that real estate?
I don't know. I can't believe that was... Maybe it's the Owl's former Airy.
Right.
Converted. And we've got the Cheshire Cat continuing to monitor everything because Big Brother points Cage in the Baron's direction. You got to go take the Baron down for me, for you, for everybody.
Can we talk about the biggest tease in this whole thing? Like, they keep talking up the cat, and then they never have a showdown between Luke and the Cheshire Cat.
I know.
Felt like we were deprived of this build-up.
Agreed. Luke visits Curtis Carr one more time and has him make a nullifier to neutralize Chemistro's powers before his assault on the Baron's castle. And sure enough, when Chemistro shows his face, Cage is able to completely depower Chemistro with one hell of a throw.
I'm just wondering how the damn thing works, because it seems like in one panel you already got it. The guy says, I don't know if it's going to work, and then all of a sudden it magically works. So
he throws it, and, you know, is it a one-sided thing? Does it have to stick that one side, or would any of the sides stuck to Canestro? Or
yeah.
It was, I mean, it just seems like a one-in-a-million shot.
Yeah, and very quick, like, it's all over so fast.
The part I didn't like was he gives up Curtis Carr, like, it's fine for Luke Cage, but he's like, you can thank Curtis Carr. And I'm thinking, you know, that guy's not going to be in jail forever, and he may want to go back and thank him personally. Like, Luke, you can't go giving up your support staff like that.
And speaking of quickly, Cage takes down the who turns out to be like a sniveling baron pretty quickly. It just,
go on, I'm sorry. It goes really fast.
Yeah, and it gets thrown right back at him. I mean, then the Baron points him back at Big Brother. That Big Brother's, he's the big bad. He's not just a criminal. He's, you know, wants the total destruction of everything. I love, though, the sequence of how Cage enters the castle with his karate chop on the catapult to catapult himself up to a door that then gets slammed in his face. He's like, nuts, I'm locked out.
Well, see, that's where the whole castle theme was a mistake, having the big wooden doors, because no wooden door is going to keep him out.
Issue number 40 has a John Romita Sr. cover. And what is funny to me is the creator credits states, introducing Lee Elias, the artist, with Frank Giacoa, the embellisher. And Lee Elias, I mean, this is the end of 1976, for Pete's sake. Lee Elias has been around since, like, the 40s and 50s, drawing.
Yeah, I had to go look his name up, because I know I wanted to be a little bit prepared, because I know you'd be like, throwing names out there and stuff, so I was curious. And I'm like, man, this guy, he seems like another one of those artists that Marvel had in the 70s where they were like kind of at the end of their careers.
That's right.
And they're just like throwing them on books and stuff, you know, where they could have filling. And this guy lasts, what, like three issues in this run? Three, four issues? Yeah. And the problem is, unfortunately, his art is great. It's just he's had a series of bad inkers here until he gets to Palmer and then, yeah. You know.
Where else you could find Elias? Elias was peppered through a few different fill-ins around this time in Marvel books, but he also drew much of the Human Fly series.
I read that.
Him and Frank Robbins.
I was going to say, some of his faces and figure work reminded me of Robbins. I mean, not as exaggerated at times, but I did get a Robbins vibe from him.
They're from the same time, and he did a lot of work for Across the Street as well. But this is, like you said, this is the 70s where it was Roy Thomas was the editor-in-chief and then Marv Wolfman here for a short stint. And you've got the guys who are the first wave of creators who were fans rather than the guys who were there just because it was a job, but actually fans of the medium. And these guys are their heroes. And Elias now is in his, I think, mid-50s, pushing 60 around this time. So, yeah, this is later in his career, and he's getting a shot to bounce around, and I think he does some really fine work on this book.
Yeah, you can definitely tell his style, especially when he has the right anchor, and, like, Palmer comes on and says much better, but sometimes some of the panels are just so thick with the line work, it's not his style. He's a lot more the pencils are much thinner than the inks are.
In this last issue of the arc, Luke is hot on the trail of Big Brother now. And he gets to his hideout, but it's like, where'd everybody go? It's deserted. Dessert. Fortunately, Big Brother finds him while he's taking a taxi to the hospital. And he attacks in this boxy, high-tech, poor excuse for a copter.
Where did they come up with this stuff as well?
Yeah, didn't they have reference? Big Brother snares the cab that Cage is in, and Cage climbs up to go confront Big Brother, but then they drop the cab into the water. He's going to kill the cab driver, so Cage dives in after him and saves him for a near drowning, but I mean he's almost drowned.
Was kind of interesting how like the cab driver versus Luke Cage, but Luke ends up the cab driver was not a willing participant in this situation.
He didn't even want to give him a ride in the first place. They went out of their way.
But it's been 5 issues, Steve, so isn't it time for Luke to get stuck in a death trap again?
Oh, and he is.
At the hospital, Luke is visiting with Noah and Claire. Noah Bernstein is the doctor friend of his who runs the clinic. He's the one who turned him into Power Man in the first place back in the prison way back in issue number 1. And Claire Temple is the doctor who, with the heart of gold, ex-wife of Black Goliath, who also works at the neighborhood clinic that Noah runs, where Cage engages. They're the only other supporting cast besides DW, who runs the Gem Theater.
The ticket taker, Steve?
Yeah,
how dare
barely.
You?
Barely. She's more like the madam at a hostel, you know, who you just kind of run into to throw a line out as you're passing. But at the hospital, the trio of them, Cage and Noah and Claire, are all attacked with knockout gas. And then, like you said, holy jumping crud. Cage wakes up in a death trap, strapped down to a train, a high-speed train that's being remotely controlled, and it's going to go off the tracks and into the water.
I was wondering, though, the one panel that is just really ridiculous is how he gets attached to the helicopter. It's like, how does the helicopter launch that thing in, grab him? Like, there's no sequence where it shows you this is happening, and all of a sudden, he's attached to this.
Yeah, it's really awkward. It's really awkward. Very. Something reaches in like it's a Doc Ock tentacle and grabs him and pulls him out or something. It's pretty bizarre. Just as bizarre is the physics involved in Cage's escape here. It's even more ridiculous when you wrap it down to or boil it down to that he leaps off the train, he grabs the cliff, he climbs up the cliff, and then he leaps on to Big Brother's copter. It's nutty.
He's got powerful leg muscles for a 300-pound guy, in case you didn't know, Steve. I know you were asking, how much does he weigh?
Then why does he have to take down the pole that the trapeze artist is on instead of just jumping up to him? Why can't he leap and save any of these people who have fallen to their deaths when they've jumped towards him and fallen off the ledge? Anyway, Cage, now that he's on Big Brother's copter, he fights Big Brother. They were a pretty good match for each other last time, and this time again, so Cage opts for sabotaging the aircraft instead, and then jumps free and lets Big Brother and the Cheshire Cat presumably die in an explosive crash. That'll teach him.
Yeah, and talking about physics, you got him, how is he ripping off the helicopter blade? Like,
Well, remember, it has 2 blades.
Yeah, I know, but it's just like all of a sudden, like, it goes from one panel to the next panel, and all of a sudden it just like rips. It doesn't, there's like no sequence.
And it's,
I like all
fast.
The gears and stuff that are flying when he rips it apart. Besides, he's destroyed cars, a train. He's got to destroy a helicopter to get the whole set and a bus. I mean, you know, Luke Cage does not do well with automotive conveyances.
I liked Fred Hembeck's letter on the letters page. If you noticed there, a young Hembeck saying how much he's enjoying the more classic style of scripting that we're seeing from Wolfman, and hoping that we got a stable writer on here and liking the direction. He says, even though the first few issues weren't the best of Wolfman's work, and it's funny because those were the issues scripted by Mantlo. Anyhow, issues 41 to 43 is a 3-part arc, with an Ernie Chan cover on the first issue that is unremarkable, and then a Wilson Chan cover and a Wilson Giacoa cover that improve. I like Ron Wilson's covers.
It's Thunderbolt, Steve.
Yeah. Well, this issue's on the art. We have Lee Elias still providing the pencils, and Tom Palmer providing inks on 41, and then Alex freaking Nino providing inks on issues 42 and 43. Alex Nino. Man, it looks good.
And those are really, that's the really good stuff. I think that's the best art in the whole sequences that we're talking about.
Agreed.
The way it goes, because his line work, you know, he covers it really good, and it's really impressive.
Really impressive. Well, Noah, he's out of the hospital, thank goodness. And Luke and Claire manage somewhat of a date. About time. They've been needing to catch up since the whole Black Elia thing, honestly. But, like Kevin said, there's a new superhero on the scene here that was teased on the cover. He is the Super Speedy Thunderbolt. How could we not give him his due on this podcast?
I know. No, I really like this guy. He's an adversary for Cage, and then they team up, and I'm like, yeah, I'm enjoying this.
He's got a fun power set. Like, he's got super speed and his phantom ripoff ring, so when he punches people, he gives them a lightning bolt mark. And he's got his solar flare.
I think the Black Panther did something like this later on, too.
Yeah.
You got to always get that branding so you can, you know, put your mark on people.
Literally. An armored car company hires Luke to ride along with a gold delivery of theirs in light of the super criminal gold bug's threats. And while he's on the ride, on the protection route, Thunderbolt arrives mid-delivery to also protect the shipment, but the typical hero misunderstanding fight ensues between them. And meanwhile, Goldbug steals the gold, just as he threatened he would.
You had noticed that Cage was admiring his design. He's like, oh, these are the cards he loses at the crime scene. Wow, these are actually pretty good. This is neat. I'm like, yeah, a little too much admiring there.
And why shouldn't Goldberg be Goldberg? Why shouldn't Goldbug be successful? Because it turns out that he's his civilian identity. He's the armored car company suit that hired Luke in the first place. So he knew intimately, you know, where the delivery was going to and from, and all that sort of stuff.
I like his gimmick, anyways.
Yeah, he's a little too gold oriented, though.
Well, you know, the Beyonder, you know, he might be interested in some gold.
Luke and Thunderbolt, they come to terms with each other, and they return to Luke's office, which is no longer glass. I don't know how that worked out, but it is. Maybe he got Curtis to whip him up something to fix it back or something.
Yeah.
And Goldberg is there at the office in his civilian guise with the cops, and he wants to arrest the duo for all of the missing gold. Dun, dun, dun. It seems like a big cliffhanger, but in the next issue, Luke pretty quickly diffuses the situation by explaining that, hey, look, I was hired, and it was stolen, you know, and kind of sends them on their way. Then we get the best part here. We get the origin of Thunderbolt.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Want to give us any of the details?
You're gonna give it to me. Well, he's a young guy. Whatchamacallit? Is it? I can't remember. Okay.
He like works for a DA, right?
Yeah.
Or where he was the DA.
Yeah, and his kid gets killed somehow, and he thinks it's an accident, but then he realizes it's like an assassination of some sort, and because the assassin follows him to the funeral, and this lightning bolt comes down and hits he's in a struggle with the guy, and lightning bolt comes down, hits him, and he ends up getting super strength from it. And they said because it was something, he's got a cobalt treatment. I guess we're talking about that. That's what it says. We discovered a radiation leakage in the cobalt treatment. So that's how he combined with the electricity that was in his body, makes him fast and stuff like that.
So wait, they have a method to make all these super soldiers now?
I guess.
I don't want to volunteer to get hit by lightning bolts and see if the cobalt works.
Actually, it was two accidents, right? It was an accident getting hit with the lightning bolt and then going to the hospital, try to get saved, and becomes a superhero. So.
But I did go and pull up on Marvel Unlimited Daredevil 69. It was kind of fun. It was him and Black Panther. That's the origin before he's Thunderbolt. It's like the backstory of it. And I was like, that's a cool way to mine fun stuff from the past. And it was like Gene Colan drawing Daredevil and Black Panther. And it's on Marvel Unlimited.
Cool. Luke and Thunderbolt meet up, team up, and go to track down Goldberg. They assault his hideout. And, I mean, I love these fight sequences as embellished by Nino, the noodling on the, you know, clothes. I mean, it's almost like Jack Davis-y. It almost looks like Jack Davis inked by John Severin in some places. It's really hot.
Yeah, you are correct. That's one of the things I was thinking about. A lot of the art here, the guy Lee Elias is like from that era, and it's really very like Mad Magazine-esque.
There's this two-panel sequence that I'll post of him rolling a tire after a guy who's running, and you see it from the first panel is from shot from behind Cage, where the guy is little in the distance, having it rolled towards him, and then in the next panel, he's in the close-up, and you're shooting back, and you see Cage little in the background making the shot. It's just so nicely done.
Yeah.
And speaking of Daredevil, it reminds me of, you talk about the artists from that age, it reminds me of some of that Bill Everett stuff that we saw in those first issue of Daredevil there with some of the clowns that he was fighting. These guys are definitely clowns.
So do the more expensive, like, places have this capsule technology where you can just escape really fast if you want? If you have somewhere to go in a hurry?
Well, if you're if you got a lot of gold, I guess. The duo get stuck in this rocket pod, but they escape off panel and meet up with Goldberg. Goldberg again. I'm going to keep doing that. Meet up with the gold bug while he's getting in his craft, escaping, and they like leap onto the craft and get on board in a dramatic fashion.
This book really is doing the James Bond thing that we've seen before too much, but I also really enjoyed the panel where he's having lady trouble, and there's this sad panel where he has to blow off her, and she's got, like, this tear coming out of her eye, and she just looks devastated. Like,
that's
nice.
The classic illustration stuff, you know, it goes back to that age. Like, it reminds me of, like, those issues of Night Nurse, and they always sort of girl crying like that, exactly like that, and that kind of, like, face, and it's really cool. Very well done.
When you mentioned earlier, Andrew, Dr. Doom getting punched in the chest and the look on Dr. Doom's face when you kind of realize that Doom's gone soft inside and realize, uh-oh, something just broke, you know, from that previous issue where Luke wants to get his money, honey. Similarly here, when Goldberg, I'm going to keep doing that, I swear. When Goldbug gets smashed into, and he likes gold and everything. No, just kidding. When he gets smashed into the control panel, the look of horror on the next page on Goldbug's face. I mean, that's the Dr. Doom just went soft inside look right there.
Yeah.
Well, the reason why he's freaked is the controls are unresponsive, and the aircraft is out of control, and it's heading directly into Times Square, a populated Times Square, midday.
Yeah, and Thunderbolt just happens to make a phone call.
It's like all the planets are in alignment that thing is going down right there in Times Square, not like, you know, four blocks down, five blocks up.
It's all right, though. Cage and Thunderbolt divert the trajectory of the damaged craft with all of their super abilities. Cage pounds on the wing, and Goldbug, this time it's Thunderbolt, leaps from the craft and doesn't die himself and is able to do, like, speedy stuff to help slow it down with manipulating air currents and things.
Yeah, but we're already into issue 43. You forgot to announce that.
Oh, well, yeah, I kind of announced the arc as a whole arc. This one kind of flows together as one big scene. The duo, they split before the cops arrive.
Didn't that, the plummet reminded me, Steve, we covered that, the Marvel comic movie adaptation of, like, the meteor or whatever. Yeah. It was very reminiscent of that for me. But if anything should happen to Danny Rand, I really hope he teams up with Thunderbolt. Because one of my favorite panels is Luke getting a piggyback ride.
That's the escape I was speaking of. Exactly. They're like, let's scram. And it's like, boom, you get the big old Luke on Thunderbolt's back going super fast. And then the cop scratching his head, hey, I could have sworn I saw somebody standing here.
I could read a lot of comics on that. No, it's Thunderbolt.
That's right.
With his glazier mask. At Luke's office, Luke gets the ultimatum he's been dreading. Show up at the office, the IRS office tomorrow with your papers, or there's going to be trouble. You're going to jail, buddy. Luke instead decides to split town and head to Chicago.
Well, we have the classic Western. I like that it doesn't have a name anymore. I mean, we still have Shane playing. We also just have classic Western.
Well, I think
that's
Shane.
Is it.
Yeah.
That is the name of a movie?
Yeah.
No. Jack Palance and Alan Ladd are in Shane.
Exactly.
So if you read that's the way, just the way it looks.
Yeah.
Maybe, I just like the classic Western.
Maybe it's a moving marquee. The top line is moving. That'd be cool. So Luke assumes the identity of Mark Lucas. But on the train, after saying his goodbyes, on the train, he gets recognized by none other than his arch nemesis. It's Gideon Mace.
Oh, no.
You guys all laughed at me. He's like his greatest enemy.
He is.
Well, I hadn't read the story yet, and I was like, yeah, I guess he is kind of serious, but he's and kind of crazy, but he replaced his hand with a mace. Like, I don't know, that shows you how level-headed he is.
Yeah, but it's a cool character, though. It's always, that's behind, like, Chemistro, like, Gideon Mace is like, it is Luke Cage. Like, you know, that's like one of his characters, and it's just always been, since I was a child, I just loved it.
Well, but there's, like, a lot of... as I'm reading more and more titles from this era, it seems like there's a lot of centennial type of stories about, like, America's past and America's future.
Well, this was America's Bicentennial was the year before in 76, so everyone's feeling that spirit, certainly. Luke and Mace, of course, battle. And Luke gets thrown from the train. Crud. And then I notice, without his bags, double crud. It's all right, though, because Luke meets up with a benevolent woman named Burgundy. Who cleans him up.
My name is Burgundy.
Yeah, and I happen to have a supply of silk yellow shirts for you to change into after you get a shower.
Yeah, that's a little too suspicious.
And, you know, if you're stuck here, you got no stuff, you got no job, my employer is hiring, so come meet him.
You know, as long as it's not too illegal.
No. Come right up. You'll love this guy. His name? Gideon Mace.
Telling you guys, if you look like Luke Cage, you'd probably get picked up by a lot more hitchhiking drivers, too. Just saying.
Issue 44 has a Gil Kane, Dan Atkins cover that really looks out of place with what we've been getting. The art team is Elias and Palmer. And we've got Cage being confronted by Mace again. And he's got to fight his way out through him and his goons.
I've noticed one bad thing I've noticed with the art. What's going on? They never can get the mace right. Have you noticed that? It gets bigger and smaller, and it's not because the panel is smaller, because there's smaller panels where it's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's other panels where it's just way small.
He doesn't have a thing in there where it, like, can change shape a little bit?
Yeah, okay.
Well, he has a lot of different things in there. Like, it shoots out, like, some guy, like, gas, and I was thinking, wait a second, is this like Kingpin's cane? You have all these different controls?
They keep Cage at bay with the threats of these exploding bullets that would pierce even his steel hide. And Mace has a lot of goons. His goon squad here, his commandos, are all rejected, overzealous military men.
And he wants non-volunteers for his army that basically become Batman. That's what I figured out. I don't know how that's going to work out for him, but we'll see.
I was thinking, and Cage could have been an officer to these guys if he had only taken up Gideon Mace's offer the last time around when he wanted Cage to join him. And, oh, I love, too, the sign on the wall, the combat training Arena D. It's got, like, his little mace symbol, like silhouette symbol. That's hilarious.
Also, he's just a good bad guy because he monologues like the Red Skull and Dr. Doom and all those guys. Mace just, you know, he's not only going to beat you up, he's going to give you a talking to.
And he seems somewhat honorable. I mean, he's pledged to this bloodless coup with no unnecessary deaths and all.
And he tried to save Burgundy's husband.
Right. Cage, when he makes his escape, this scene freaked me out a little bit because he goes out the window with a commando on his back who is, like, diving towards him. And in the air, he purposely shifts midair so that the average Joe guy hits first and then Cage lands on top of him. Talk about how much he weighs and everything. Holy crud, I was thinking. And Cage walks away satisfied with the fact that he's breathing. That's cool. It's more like, that's cold. That's cold.
Hey, he did that guy a favor. He's got him out of active duty, and that guy won't be doing, won't have to go to target practice.
Yeah, Spider-Man, though, he doesn't even have a steel hard hide, and he's twisted around to take the impact, not trying to twist around to make the guy hit first. Jeez. And then land on top of him. Thud. Yikes. Well, Cage now, he's on the run in a strange foreign land, Chicago, and seeks out Burgundy, who tells him the story of her husband in Vietnam with Mace, and that Mace saved him as he was going off recklessly and triggered an explosive and was actually, like, reaching out to grab a hold of him, and that's how Mace's hand got blown off. So you get Mace's origin there as well.
Yeah, but I want to see the decision-making. Like, at one point he goes, I have no hand. Can I put a chainsaw on this? Like, I want to see the decision-making process here.
Hey, if your last name was, we know you'd be putting a whirlwind on the end. You got to go with what your name says.
What does that even mean?
Just be grateful.
Put a whirlwind on the end.
Just be grateful his name wasn't Gideon Toothbrush.
Or like the guy that puts the giant blades on the end of his hands. Like, I don't know, guys.
Like they said on Seinfeld about Edward Scissorhands. What's he going to do in the bathroom? What's he going to do on the toilet? Not good to have blade fingers all the time. Well, Burgundy, you know, she betrays Cage yet again and alerts Mace that Cage is there, and his goons take down Cage again. Well, kind of Mace does with a mace to the face. Burgundy, after hearing Cage spout out some propaganda against Mace, Burgundy goes and researches Mace's military records and learns, basically, that he's a nut. And from that, somehow, illogically, but correctly, apparently, assumes that Mace is the one who actually killed her husband. I mean, there was nothing in that story that she saw, the information, that discounts Mace's story about what happened and him losing his hands and all of that, right? But
she wanted to believe.
Yeah, she's like, oh my gosh, she's crazy? Forget it. Now he's the one who killed my husband, and she's going to return to the base after him. And yeah,
well,
Mace is nuts.
I think when you combine with his, remember, he right before then, he told her a lot of people are going to die. Like, he's clearly shifted his rhetoric to be a little harsher.
Yeah, this is going to be a bloodless coup to I'm going to murder everyone.
Yeah, he's nuts and a killer, turns out. Just like Cage said, he has Luke chained to a bomb, a cobalt bomb,
But this is the thing. You read a few issues about the Cobalt. He's going to set up a bomb with, and it's a Cobalt bomb, and I'm thinking, and then there might be radiation. I'm like, if a thunderstorm moves in, like, it's not going to be a lot of people with superpowers running around.
The radiation from this Cobalt bomb will radioactively kill all the people in Chicago, but leave all of the infrastructure standing so that he can kind of defend Chicago as this fortress that he's going to rule. And I'm thinking, this radioactive wasteland that he's going to rule. Like, I don't know if he's thought this all the way through. Okay. But the last page of this issue, of issue 44, is a great splash page of Mace in all his glory. He's got his mouth open, his eyes closed. He's taking a wide base of support with his stance, and he's swinging that mace higher up than his head. I love it.
Plus, he's got some weird kind of mesh shirt, like those kind of see-through shirts people wear in the clubs and everything. Like, he's pretty hip.
Issue 45 sports a Jim Starlin cover, which, it's got a cool face, but the proportions are kind of wonky.
It's because he's underwater.
It almost looks Howard Chaykin-y in places, too. The way some of the work is around the arm and stuff. I wonder, though, some of the way the clothes look. And here, and in the next dish, in 46, Lee Elias does his own inks, the pencils and inks. This I really like. I like this a lot. I would have been happy if this was the ongoing art for you know, as long as Elias was willing to do it.
So shadowy.
So he's not, Irv Watanabe is not a real person?
No. I like his face, the faces and everything. Looks really good. Irv Watanabe.
Well, there's that actor, Ken Watanabe.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So I thought maybe he was his dad or something.
Not the inker. Elias does the inks here, though. Cage is chained to the Cobalt bomb in a sewer cavern under Chicago that's also rapidly filling with water.
Death and has time. Rats.
Yes.
Is there any more things you can add to that? And the ceiling's going to collapse.
Although, the internet has that there was an Irv Watanabe.
There's an Irv Watanabe. He's just not the inker on this issue. It's Elias doing pencils and inks.
Oh, that's right. He's the letterer. That's right. He's the artist. Never mind. Go back to your regularly scheduled thing. I can't read.
So, no, it gave us time to build the drama of Cage stuck in this death trap. How's he going to escape? You've been dying to know, and here goes Andrew. No, just kidding. He pounds the ground with his feet. And between that pounding and the weight of the bomb and the water pressure when the chamber fills, it breaks the floor, and Lucas is freed in the crash. The crash of the bomb against the rocks. I'm thinking, yikes!
Yeah, but those bombs, like nuclear bombs and stuff, they don't go off that way. Like, it has to be the reaction. Like, it's not a nitroglycerin bomb.
That's how the Cobalt bomb works?
Well, I assume it's a nuclear-style reaction. Yeah, but those require the...
Cobalt works funny in this arc. you never know.
Well, there's going to be a secret we're going to find out at the end. I'm not going to spoil it, but...
Burgundy.
You know, that bomb may Burgundy, not be as...
Burgundy, the femme fatale here, she comes around and alerts the military moments before Mace makes his ultimatum to the military, which is what exactly? He gives them an hour to decide what? What's the proposition? He says, I got a proposition for you. What? I mean, it's really... that. I mean, that's pretty spotty plotting and scripting there.
He's going to blow up the city.
Or what? He says you guys got an hour and this and that. I mean, what's the... I've got a proposition for you. What's the deal he's offering?
Oh, he had to turn over all of Chicago. He was going to run...
Yeah.
He mentioned that somewhere. I don't remember where.
He's a little crazy, though, so sometimes... Like, if something doesn't line up, I'm like, maybe he's just crazy.
Yeah.
Like, and there's that whole sequence where, like, Well, what if they don't agree, and then the bomb goes off, and you're still in the city, in your residence there? And he's like, well, that's not going to happen anyways. And you're just like, yeah.
Luke reunites with Burgundy. Why? I'm not sure, but why would you want to? But she's betrayed him twice already. But now, together, they storm Mace's headquarters. And I like the sequence
But I thought he could trigger the bomb somehow. That's why no one was going after his headquarters. Like, no one wanted to risk attacking him.
Forget about that, Kevin. They're attacking the headquarters. And I like the sequence where three goons attack in one panel, and then three goons get hit in the next panel. It's like, no loose ends there. Clunk, clunk, clunk. Pretty good. And we finally get Cage versus Mace. And don't forget, Mace's mace shoots Mace in your face.
Of course it does.
Mace has weaponry all around his headquarters. And they start shooting at and hitting Cage so he can again go shirtless. But what happened about the exploding bullets? They're not equipped with the exploding bullets. So he can get hit here, but not killed.
Yeah, apparently they're not as good as he thought they were.
Oh, you think he is using them, but they're just not as effective?
Yeah, like maybe they just bruise him up or something, or he only had a limited number.
I think they just it's just not convenient to still have such a thing exist. Burgundy tries to help with a flamethrower.
Which has, like, no effect, and I don't know why.
Finally, I mean, this has got to end. Cage bull rushes Mace into an elevator shaft, but Cage grabs the cables, and, well, Mace can't grab much of anything.
That does seem like a cruel irony.
That's as bad as when he sunk in the drink, you know? It's like, that Mace, unscrewing your Mace doesn't help you now. So he's presumed dead. The problem, though, is that none of his henchmen know how to deactivate the bomb.
Well, wasn't he going to get the device? Because Mace is the only one that can do it. But then he kills them off. Oh, well, they'll just have to find it. Maybe it's just like a TV remote just hanging around somewhere.
I hope that's not the last we ever see of Mace.
No way. He's like the Red Skull. You can't stop him.
I do believe he comes back in the Power Man Iron Fist stuff.
Then he's going to clone Luke's body, just like the Red Skull does. Except he'll cut off his hand and put a mace on it.
And Dave, you never read much of the Power Man Iron Fist stuff?
I was trying to answer. I only read through it once, I think. I mean, I have read them, but I don't remember any much of it.
Because that's the
stuff. So I need to do that.
That's the stuff I've been dying to get to with all of this. So we're going to keep going on, right? I'm hoping to go right up to issue 100 because that 75 to 100 is really my sweet spot of that book.
Yeah, I mean, I know right after this is the masterful issue.
issue 46, give us a real nice Ron Wilson, Ernie Chan cover. Where Cage is taking on a mob in the foreground while kids are seemingly innocently exploring the bomb in the background.
Which looks highly detailed and everything.
Yeah, Ernie, you know, Ernie Chan.
I don't think that's how the bomb was in the issue.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It looks very highly detailed and everything compared to what it was.
So no one knows how to deactivate this bomb, so in this issue, which is sort of like an epilogue issue and Wolfman's last issue as well. Everyone's searching for the bomb in Chicago, and it's winter, there's a light snowstorm happening, which then I'm thinking back to the previous stuff, that makes the sewer water that Cage was in seem really cold now, doesn't it?
Didn't this remind you guys of that the Christmas issue, too?
Yeah.
Where it was like very much like a flashback to the... Maybe that'll be a tradition. They have these kind of crazy Christmas issues where he just encounters smaller stories that add up.
There's a lot of...
Good. I was going to say it's the summer of 1977, though. which is odd.
But it's Chicago, though.
Fair enough.
I agree. I've been there in some of them C2E2s in April, and it felt like Christmas to me.
This is a weird issue, though. There's all these different threads happening that seem just like almost random scenes that then are threads that come together. Lucas saves an elderly woman from some thugs, and then she goes home, has a heart attack, and starts a kitchen fire. Then I'm thinking Marv must have had a bad experience in Vermont or something, because he depicts this person from Vermont as like a redneck survivalist, extreme right-winger type who travels to Chicago in search of his woman who's running with a fast crowd and stuff. And he's sniper style, shoots like her agent or like entertainment agent or somebody who made the call that brought her to Chicago or whatever.
She's supposed to be a model.
Okay. That makes sense because she's a cutie. And while in shooting this fellow, Cage happens to be walking by, or running by, actually. And a couple of the bullets, he notices the bullets, he goes in, he finds the body, he sees the shooter running, and goes and chases after him to this, like, fat cat party. And you hear the whole story, and Luke takes him down.
He's just trying to get rid of a bomb, and people keep on interrupting him.
And just then, Burgundy shows up in a helicopter. You know, Mace has extra helicopters laying around, and she makes the point to mention that because he trusted her so implicitly, he even showed her how to fly the thing.
Well, Mace was nice.
So she flies the helicopter and picks up Cage, claims to know where the bomb is, which, again, I'm thinking, so what good does that do to them? Because Luke was already right with the bomb and was no help in defusing it. He left the bomb, in fact, to go get help. But while
now he figures there's nothing left. Why not try it? And I think that helicopters with only one giant blade are a lot easier to fly than the dual blades on each side. So, you know.
Luke, in the air, sees the flames from an apartment building.
From a apartment.
Yeah, he recognizes that it's the old woman's building that he, like, led her to, that he helped out with the thugs and all that. So they put down and help her out, literally and, then, and figuratively there.
Yeah, he needs to hurry up before her cat eats her.
Cats will do that.
The cat is giving her CPR. Can't you tell?
You say CPR, I say the cat's going to eat her. Get over there, Luke.
Now, finally, off to the bomb. And just like on the cover, although not quite as detailed as the cover, the kids are all playing around it. It's washed up on the shore, which is a long way from the sewer, but whatever. Any bomb will do at this point, even if it's not the real bomb. And, earlier in the issue, they spent an awkward page showing two cops who were searching the sewers for the bomb, and they're, like, talking to each other, and you're getting to know way too much about them. I was thinking it was a nod back to that storytelling style that had existed previously on the book where they spent some time, but it was mostly in the caption boxes where they would more cleverly mention a couple of interesting points about a character. Here were two guys talking to each other, and it took the whole page for them to do it, but here's the payoff. They show up just as Lucas is about to try punching the bomb to submission.
Hey, that worked with the gas that was going to be released. Right? He was able to punch that.
The highly volatile canister, when he punched it in the street until it stopped wanting... Well, no, that exploded in his face. Maybe... with that as precedent, maybe he shouldn't try punching the bomb. And the kids are all still around? I don't know.
Well, what else? It's going to blow up anyway. Like, so it blows up 2 seconds earlier? Go for it. Punch away. No. Swing away, Meryl. Swing away.
Not so fast, Sonny. The police show up and have a great suggestion, Andrew, that you alluded to earlier.
Why don't you, there's a button on the side.
Not just any button, a deactivation button.
Seems to be right. I don't know how he recognized what a deactivation button, but that's what 20 years on the force gives you, Steve, the ability to recognize a deactivation button right when, you know, you need to. But I do like that that's right after the bomb squad shows up.
And it starts ticking. Tick, 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 tick. Well, in the end... Go on.
What if you're in the sewers, though, and like a rock or something hits the bomb right where the button is?
I know. I'm surprised that it wasn't bumped there somewhere along the way. Or was it? It could have been. Because in the
Maybe it's been going on and off.
Well, it doesn't matter. It turns out when they get it back to the lab, the bomb's been a fake all along.
I told you it was crazy.
Mace had been saying, and he tipped his hand to the military even, that validated him having the bomb, of saying that there was this bomb, cobalt bomb, that the military lost off Bikini Island or something like that, and he's got it. And the military's like, shoot, we did lose a bomb, he must have it, that kind of a thing. Well, it turns out that this bomb is a bomb, but it's inactive, and it's not the bomb from the Bikini Islands. Mace only heard about that and used it as a bluff. And the real bomb that went missing, we'll find out about the recovery efforts in Marvel 2-in-1, issue number 34, which is The Thing and Nighthawk, which has nothing... It doesn't. It has nothing to do with it. I don't know. It was supposed to? I'm going to have to maybe look at the issue after and before, because it's a dead link, my friends.
It's weird. It's because it says, see the results.
Yeah, that issue has Nighthawk going to England to visit one of his company, constituencies, and there's some weird, like, monster that then gets shot by some civilians in the end. But the monster had saved a girl, and then it was like, oh, the parents are like, you killed the monster that saved my daughter. It wasn't such a monster after all. But it had really nothing to do with this. But anyway.
I think it's a metaphor, Steve.
For the Bikini Island experiments.
Yes. He recovered the bomb in the sense that he discovered that the monster wasn't really a monster. So what seemed to be a horrific thing wasn't.
My God. Anyway, if this bomb was a fake, then all of this rigmarole, this whole thing was a waste of time. Or was it, Cage thinks. And that's when he thinks back of saving the elderly woman twice, and finding the murdered guy and taking down the sniper and saving the other girl. You know, not too shabby of a night. Wah, wah. But I got to say again, out of these last two issues, Elias providing his own inks, fantastic. Right up there with Nino inking him, and right up there with the best of the Billy Graham stuff earlier in the run. This is the best the book has gotten art-wise, I think, right up there.
Yeah.
I'll also jump in with Dave and say I like the Tom Palmer inks as well.
Yeah. Well, that's your go-to guy. I mean, he's one of the best inkers on the planet, you know? So, what you gotta do?
In the next chunk of issues, Chris Claremont is gonna jump on board as writer and bring in Iron Fist, along with a couple of art fill-in issues penciled by John Byrne and Mike Zeck.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Got that to look
forward still
to.
Is he still going to mention that he's a sometimes defender and a temporary Fantastic Four member?
We'll see. He does mention that a lot in this, didn't he? Go to the defender piece? Yeah, I can't call the defenders now because of this or that. It's interesting. And I got to say, too, that Power Man, the Luke Cage Power Man 7-Eleven Slurpee Cup from the 70s is the only original Slurpee Cup I still have left.
Wow.
It made it through a house fire in 1980. And it's pretty worn, but it's got Luke on the front, and on the back it's got him with a little blurb. I used to be called Luke Cage Hero for Hire, but I dropped that name after I realized that the guy with the money isn't always the guy who's right. So now I'm on my own, and you can call me Power Man. Copyright 1975.
Wow, so that cup's made of steel hard material or something.
Cobalt.
Yeah.
Pretty funny. I'll post a picture of my Power Man Slurpee cup from 1975.
Yeah, that'd be pretty awesome. I've never seen one of those, I don't think.
I don't remember what flavor was in it, but knowing me, it was probably cola.
Still, you probably still, I'm sure that stuff etched into the contents of the cup forever. So.
Yeah, leached into the plastic.
You just got to run around waiting for a lightning bolt to hit it, Steve.
So any other thoughts on, I mean, even on the whole Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, and Power Man solo title as it's been up to this point? I mean, everything changes after this, so this is a good place to take stock to where we're at.
Since I haven't been on the other episodes and that, I had it like, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to come on here is I kind of have to defend this book a little bit because you guys have been pretty harsh. And, you know, Luke Cage has always been one of my favorite characters since I was a child. I mean, this is like one of the earliest characters I was ever introduced to. You know, so I must have been like six maybe when I first read my first ones. And then, like, you know, it just went on till that point. But right till about after this is when I stopped reading it when I was a kid. So I can't, like, say about, you know, the team-up, you know, issues afterwards too much. I mean, I have read them since. But this is really, like, a big, you know, it's always been about street-level characters for me. And, like, Luke Cage, you can't get more street-level than that. I mean, you know, it's always been...
Do you prefer the type of stories where he's dealing with, like, mob characters and characters with just slight little power sets like the Cheshire Cat and Cottonmouth Jones and stuff like that? Or do you want to see him go up against, you know, the Kingpin and Doc Ock and stuff?
Yeah, it would be like, I mean, but those are like, I would consider them, they're not overly powered. Like, you know, he's not like, you know, when he goes up against, when they put him like, you know, they were trying to find his way early, you know, with the Doctor Doom book and all that kind of stuff. This guy was kind of silly, you know? And it's like, you know, if you keep them, you know, just like, you know, like Daredevil or anything, when you keep them more, like, centered down to, you know, like, street-level stuff, it's more interesting to me, you know, because once they get out of their skill set too much, like, you know, most of those kind of characters, it gets, you know, just a little weird. You know, cause you know they're out of their element. There's no way, you know, he's going to be fighting Doctor Doom no matter what, you know. There's no way he's supposed to win. No.
And I came on it exactly opposite as you, but at the same time, like I'm like 6 years old, starting to read, you know, 5 or 6 years old, reading comics. I guess it was more like when I was 4 and 5 because I was reading before kindergarten there. But I was reading all of the Iron Fist stuff and only picking up a couple of Cage issues here and there. So it was Iron Fist that brought me to the book, and it would be this after this next chunk of books that I would become a regular reader, you know, just the opposite. But I like your comment about him not getting too big and dealing with the more street level. Like in the late 70s, early 80s, I thought of it as like Power Man and Iron Fist were on the ground of the street level characters, and Daredevil and Moon Knight were on the rooftops. And between them, there was enough menaces for them to deal with them all.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's figuratively. I mean, saying I still consider Moon Knight and Daredevil totally street. You know, that's just, you know, just because they can.
But on the rooftops of the street, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's still like, you know, everybody's power set is still kind of, you know, a little bit more than a normal man or something like that. Maybe Luke Cage is more powerful than that, but, you know, we discussed before, like, they, you know, they kind of, like, upped his power, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of silly, where he cannot pick up a bus. I'm sorry.
Right.
That's not his skill set, you know. But it's just always been, he was always been an important character to me. And so now in this day and age, I'm just happy to see that, you know, there's a television show and they were, you know, he's more of a bigger player in Marvel Universe, you know, over the years.
In a big way, I think we have Bendis to thank for that, his love of the character, because he really added him to kind of every big project he was working on, you know what I mean, in the beginning of the 2000s and beyond, whether it was the Jessica Jones stuff or the Avengers stuff and whatnot. And
yeah, the new Avengers, that was like really big.
And whether it's deserved or not, based on Bendis's handling of the character, certainly the executives think of him as their darling. So any of the characters that he's spending time on, they look to, hey, maybe this is the next one. And I think because of that, the attention got on Cage, and rightly so. I think he's perfect for especially for the TV stuff where you can do more characterization and aren't looking so much at big portals opening up in the sky and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I think the design of the character too was very. I mean, I know he's changed everything, but there was something about. I think choosing yellow was like a really. It's not a lot of heroes that I can think of that have yellow as their primary thing. For some reason, that I always liked that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the chain belt.
It was supposed to be outlandish. Yeah, and the chain belt and all that. It was like outlandish. You know, it was supposed to be. And all his villains were like outlandish. So. But I do think Chemistro was one of the best conceived, like the idea of it, you know.
Sure.
I mean, I wish she would have became more of a villain in the Marvel Universe, like sort of like a Taskmaster or something, you know, where, you know, he would pop up every once in a while or become like, you know, I'm not even sure if he was like in a group of villains, you know, like one of those, you know, super villain groups. But
Masters
I think it was totally really?
No, I don't know. Oh.
I'm just saying, like, you know, he's always been interesting on the level of, like, some of the other mid-level villains, like, you know, like the Prowler or something like, or different things, you know, different characters.
The problem with Chemistro kind of ascending to that role, I think, goes right back to his origin, though. The tragedy of, not necessarily his origin, but that first appearance is that he shot himself in the foot. And he and in recovering from that, Curtis does not, you know, he doesn't want to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
So he's always had that baggage, even though we get a Chemistro 2 and a Chemistro 3 even down the line. And I honestly forget which Chemistro ends up being almost an ally to them. It's you know, dozens of issues down the line. But yeah, Chemistro lingers on as one of the regular recurring characters that we see now and again, and rightly so.
Yeah, it's a cool idea.
And Gideon Mace. You gotta like him.
Yeah. Like I said, that's the other guy, like, in this whole series of books, where it's just a cool concept, like, you know, to get the Mace and the way, you know, he's like this wacko military guy, you know, and it's always been like, you know, and they brought him back a couple times, and that, you know, was pretty cool.
All right, well, this episode was brought to you by Cobalt. And I want to thank you for wasting your time with us. Kevin, Andrew, as always, thanks for participating in this madhouse asylum that we run here. And Dave, this was awesome having you come back. All of the doing the cage things and having you comment on them on our Facebook page. I was hoping that would be
really,
enough of a teaser.
I really started getting back into the show just listening to it again, because you guys are still, like, you know, on your game, you know, so it's cool.
That's nice of you to say, and I hope that you will always consider the invitation open to come back anytime that we're doing anything that interests you.
Sure.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. I appreciate it, guys.
All right, gang, until Cage trades in his yellow silks for some 70s tweed, make mine Marvel. Later.
No sun will shine in my day today.
No sun will shine.
The high yellow moon won't come out to play. I am bound.